Interview with Paul Wendells, September 18th, 2007, in New York City, by Kenneth Durr.
I generally ask folks how they got interested in law, and I suppose with you, your father may have a lot to do with it.
Yes, my father was a lawyer, and I grew up in a household in which the law sort of permeated thought, and my father also had at one time in his career he became very much involved in public affairs. One, when he was a very young lawyer, was with a young ambitious politician named Fiorello LaGuardia, who was running for chairman of the Board of Estimate in New York, and this was just pre World War I, and nobody gave him much of a hope or anything like that, but my father was asked to be his campaign manager, which he did. My father, the campaign was successful, and LaGuardia was elected to be the head of the Board of Estimate. And since then, until recent years, they were absolutely inseparable. They were different types, to be sure. LaGuardia was a brilliant, he was dramatic, he was emotional, and so forth. My father was very studious. He had a truly academic mind. He constantly read, and he remembered everything he read. And so it happened that this boy whose father was a Methodist minister and died when my father was, my grandfather died when my father was 14 years old and had to leave school and go to work. And he went to work with one of these importing firms, a dye and chemical firm downtown New York. But he was constantly reading, and a partner of the firm, who happened to be a friend of Nicholas Murray Butler, suggested to Dr. Butler that he really should meet my father, or this young boy who was sort of a messenger and doing everything in the office. So my father went up, and he had never finished high school, but Dr. Butler spoke to him for a while, a lot about the Civil War and a lot about other things, and he took my father in and put him in the sophomore year at Columbia. So then my father was a friend, close friend of Dr. Butler's for his whole life. And so he finished Columbia, went to Columbia Law School. And then Dr. Butler got an urgent request from a principal of Rasmus Hall High School that they needed a history teacher. And my father's family always needed money back in those days. So he went over and taught history, American history, but he had to go to law school at night, so he switched over to Brooklyn Law School, which started the connection with Brooklyn Law School. And so that's sort of my a part of my background. Let's see, let's go up to when LaGuardia was elected mayor, and my father became corporation counsel.
Right.
And he took over the law department of an administration in which the city was frankly for sale. The big racket was the condemnation racket, and all the political insiders were making money by buying into land for nothing and then having it condemned for very high prices. And so my father, as corporation counsel, went after them very, very vigorously, and they were really connected in New York, because this administration, the Democratic administration, had been there and it was wealthy and so forth. And so John W. Davis was one of the defendants of these people who had been making this money. But my father brought out legal actions against them and set aside a number of the awards, totaling well over $50 million. And that was a big thing in those Depression years. But I remember that myself when I was very young, and I was I was very sort of close to LaGuardia growing up, and I used to go to ball games with him, and I can remember very vividly the last time I saw him, because you see, when Governor Lehman was looking for a special prosecutor, he named Thomas E. Dewey, a young lawyer who was a Republican, and he figured this is a good way to take the heat off me and take the heat off the Democrats nationally, particularly FDR, who wanted this Tammany Hall thing obliterated, get it out of the way.
Right.
And so when it was announced that Thomas E. Dewey would be the special prosecutor, we were in Westport, and my father was having lunch with Fiorello and with just a minute now, that lawyer that, at any rate, it was announced that Dewey would be the special prosecutor, and I can remember them all saying, "That dope Herbie, how could he do such a politically stupid thing?" Because, of course, Dewey eventually knocked off Lehman,
right.
And also he blocked LaGuardia by becoming governor, he locked LaGuardia into City Hall. LaGuardia had no place else to go but Washington,
right.
And he was a resourceful, mobile kind of a fellow, and so he did go to Washington, and in 1940 he came out for Roosevelt, and that broke up the relationship with my father, because my father was a staunch Republican, but
right.
They went their separate ways. My father had been in law school with FDR as a young man, and had developed a dislike for him as a very early age. Young Roosevelt was in New York for one thing, and that is to go to coming out parties. His mother didn't want him to waste his time in Boston. He wanted him to be in New York with a better grain of society, better element of society.
Pardon me, gentlemen. Can I get you anything? Tea? Or
water would be great.
Water?
Thank you.
Terrific. How about you, Mr. Wendell's? Water, tea, coffee?
What? I'm having some water.
Sure. Thank you. Some water. Yes. Thank you, Dee. Thank you very much.
So you were watching all of this happen. Had you decided by this point that you were going to be a lawyer?
Well, it was just there all the time. No, when I was really young, I was entranced by the Navy. I was entranced by farming. Mm-hmm. I guess those are two other things that attracted my attention as a boy. Mm-hmm. But politics was there, and the law was there. And the various really vivid recollections of LaGuardia. Of course, my father told him that Roosevelt was not to be trusted, and that he was a socialite on just use people and as to suit his convenience.
Now, and you would have been off to Princeton in the late 30s, is that right? For your undergraduate?
I was, in 1940, I went to Princeton.
1940. Did you know that you were going to go into law at that point?
Oh, I sort of figured that was a likelihood. Mm-hmm. Although when I was in Princeton, I did a very fortunate thing. I was in the military science program, and so that I was commissioned in the field artillery and went right into the field artillery. But before that, I was just a private in the Army, and I was home for Easter weekend leave, and I went home, and my mother, with whom I was particularly close, took me to the opera. It was Parsifal, and we went in there. I was a private in the Army. We went in there, and there was LaGuardia, F.H., and Marie, and they were sitting there. So my mother sat with Marie, and this was after, you know, there was a split between my father and LaGuardia, but mm-hmm. I went and sat with him, and my mother sat with Marie, and walking out, this was the last time I ever saw him, and we were, he was really, I always felt very close to him, extremely close. He said to me, walking out, he said, "Paul, you can't imagine what I'd give if I could change places with you." Because FDR had made it clear that, you know, he had used LaGuardia and that was it.
Right.
LaGuardia wasn't going to go over to Europe, wasn't going to, you know, have a military command or a diplomatic position or anything. He was just left to stew in his own juice. And so here he was in New York just dying on the bone. Yeah. And he was feeling very, very down.
Yeah, and he wouldn't have lasted much longer after that either. He died in 47 or so, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you finished up at Princeton. You went into the Army then.
Yes.
Is that right?
And here's how that turned out. I went in, although I went in as a private because I had this military science thing, I went almost immediately to officer candidate school and got out of that. I went into was commissioned in the field artillery. And so
did you go up to Plattsburgh? Is that where you went?
No, I didn't. I never did the Plattsburgh thing. I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And then, as I say, got my commission. And then went with various outfits, the 11th Airborne. And then that was a fortunate thing that happened to me because I was a forward observer training with a 511th Parachute Infantry. And I spent all this time training with them, and then the time came to go overseas, and the inspector general came to check out the division, and there was no, in the table of organization, there was no position for a forward observer in a field artillery, in an airborne field artillery outfit. So although I had a great attachment for the 11th Airborne, I was left there. Thank you, Dee. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
I was left where watching them all, the train leave, on the standing on the siding. Greatest thing in the world that could have happened to me. In a sense, my heart was broken, but I went back to Fort Sill and took the survey course, and then they were forming a new artillery battalion, and it was. Went to Europe, and the old 11th went over to Asia, went to New Guinea. My old outfit was all converted to infantry and just slogged through the jungles, whereas I went to Europe. I was an aerial observer. I saw that whole military operation in Europe. I saw all of Europe, the devastation of the cities, the riots, the people. It was a liberal education, and what wound up outside of Czechoslovakia, and we were told we couldn't go into Berlin because that had been decided at Yalta. So we were all held back, and then went back to Nuremberg. Our outfit was converted to military police, and the idea being to handle the business of so-called slave laborers. They then changed the name to displaced person because they weren't slave laborers at all. They didn't want to leave. We had a terrible job putting them onto trucks at bayonet point, getting them out of Nuremberg because for reasons of their own, they wanted to clean up their Nuremberg. They didn't want to have a lot of Ukrainians and miscellaneous Central Europeans floating around in Nuremberg. And so they were all loaded onto trucks, and we accomplished that. And then most of the battalion went home, and I was, the officers went home. I found myself in command of the battalion, which had been changed to military police. And then, lo and behold, there was a big riot in Normandy. And it was between the American port troops and returning French military personnel, who came back to Normandy and found that the American port troops were making a big killing out of the black market because they were operating out of Le Havre and Cherbourg. And so their pockets were bulging with money. They were all black, of course. And these returning Norman soldiers from Normandy, they were at gunpoint. That was practically like that. And so in the middle of the night, I was sent to Normandy and arrived there and immediately restricted all American soldiers to their quarters and wouldn't allow any of them to come out. There was a lot of hoo and cry about that from the soldiers, but also from the Frenchmen who were in the black market business, because they wanted to keep this thing going, but at the same time they were complaining about the soldiers with all this money. And so then I reported to General Koenig, who was in Paris, what we call China-based section. And General Koenig said, "We've got this suggestion from Washington." Washington. I said, "What is it, sir?" He said, "They're going to send over a big detachment of black wax." And I said, "Now, General, do you think that's going to sail, that's going to fly here? That these soldiers with all these French currency, they were out of Alabama and Mississippi and so forth. They're not interested in the detachment of black wax." And I always suspected that this was something that had to come from Eleanor Roosevelt, that this was one of her solutions, because she say it's a wonderful way to bring these black wax a little bit of European culture, and they can learn to speak French and learn about drinking wine and the rest of that stuff. But at any rate, that didn't happen. My recommendation was they had to close down Cherbourg and Havre, which they did. And so those two ports were closed down. And then they proceeded to close them down, and there was a big riot in an army prison in Le Mans, France. Those were all American personnel who had been convicted by courts-martial. So I went over there at night, and there was a infantry colonel put in charge in command, and I was made the adjutant. And we put down the riot in due course, you know, by segregating everybody and finally getting people separated, and then we had the problem of running a prison, something I had never done before, but. But we had an execution. We had dealing with a problem of solitary confinement and all of the rest of that. But at any rate, in due course, my recommendation was to segregate the two, and the ones that were guilty of offenses cognizable in American criminal law, and they'd send them to American penitentiaries. And the rest military offenses, and ship them into Germany, and so that's what they did, and that was the end of that.
So you got yourself some military law experience before you even went to law school.
Yeah,
sounds like.
I went to Colonel Van Bibber was assigned to Antwerp, the Antwerp port area, which he took command of, and I was designated the Judge Advocate General of Antwerp, even though I had never smelt law school. And that was the big problem there was smuggling, because the diamond things, and people with all this black market money, well, how to you know, move it, what to do with it, and if you could buy diamonds, and somehow or other smuggle that back into the U.S. And so it was from Antwerp that I went home. I got home on the 3rd of July, and then I spent the 4th of July with the family. The 5th of July, I went up to Cambridge, went up to Massachusetts, and came by Harvard Law School. And the dean happened to be there and asked me into his office. And we talked for about an hour, and he took me out, and he said, "Well, you know, we have a class started last June. Would you like to join that?" And I said, "I certainly would." So that was that. Mm-hmm. So from then on, I was in law school and went on through.
Did you have any sense of how you might like to specialize when you were in law school?
Well, I was always had the feeling of litigation. I was very much oriented toward litigation. I don't have an academic mind. I'm not going to be happy looking at indentures and loan agreements and all the rest of that. my feeling was getting into court. While I was in the Army, I was in participated in courts martials constantly, and I was got to be that I was the either the judge advocate general or the law member of one after another of these courts martials. So I was doing that steadily in the Army when the war was over and we were back in Europe. And so I got to law school, and so actually I was mostly interested in anything to do with litigation.
Did you go into private practice out of law school then?
Well, I went to a firm headed by a firm that's now no longer in existence. It was Wicks. It was Mr. Wicks's firm, and he was a practitioner of the old school, a very wealthy man. Who was chairman of the Shell Oil Company, and he had been in the Cravath firm, but split off from them because there was a in the southwest part of our country, there was all sorts of restrictions on aliens holding land, and Shell Oil was an alien. So at Cravath, they decided we'll set up a separate corporation, which will be the Shell Oil, separated from Royal Dutch and from trading and transport. And Mr. Wicks was there, and they made him the chairman of it, and he separated his firm from Cravath.
Okay.
So I went with him, and most of my work was with that. A big part of my work was with antitrust, because I said I wanted to get into litigation. So we represented a steel company, and the Federal Trade Commission started a big antitrust case against the use of basing points in steel pricing. And so that I worked on. It wasn't very long. And then...
Which company was it?
Wheeling Steel.
Okay.
Wheeling Steel. And then Governor Dewey enters the picture. And this, I have to step back a little bit, because if it will be remembered that in 1948, Governor Dewey was figured a shoo-in to become president, and he didn't make it. Then along came 1952, the Republican Convention, and I went there as on the staff of the Republican National Committee. And so I was just there, running errands and doing this and that, one thing or another. But it was a standoff because the eastern part of the party, represented by, well, you know, the eastern element, New York Times, Tribune, and et cetera,
right.
they were humiliated by this defeat of Dewey's, and they were, and the person who was left in command of the party was Robert Taft. And Robert Taft did everything he could to bother them, the convention. It was a standoff between Taft and Eisenhower, because these people from the East urgently looked around. They picked up Ike Eisenhower. They brought him over to Columbia. They brushed him up, and they gave him speeches to give, and one thing or another. And here he was. The person who was going to stand to keep control of the party, and so the trouble is, it got to the convention. There was a standoff, and it looked as if the convention was going to be deadlocked, absolutely deadlocked, and they couldn't move it in either direction. The big contingency delegation that remained uncommitted was from California. Now Dewey stayed away from the convention because he was embarrassed about the whole thing. He didn't want to be booed and all the rest of that. when it was when the standoff went on for 2 days, and here was Douglas MacArthur beginning to get stir around a little bit, saying, thinking maybe Dewey and Herb Brownell came to Chicago, and they went immediately over to the California delegation. Now, California had Senator Nolan, Senator Nixon, and Governor Earl Warren. So Dewey had run with, he knew Warren very well. He had run with Warren in 48. And Warren wanted to get on a ticket because Warren had an insatiable political ambition. He had to go. I mean, that was the way he was. And of course, Nixon was there. He was strong on this anti-communist thing that gave him some advantage. So Dewey met with them in California, and out of it came a deal, and that is Nixon was on the ticket with Eisenhower, and then Earl Warren was promised the first appointment at the Supreme Court. But before that, when Dewey was governor, there was indications of embarrassment in the judicial system of New York. And Dewey looked around and he found the most prestigious kind of a lawyer to put in charge of it, and that was John Harlan. And John Harlan happened to be the senior partner of the old Root firm, Roots headed by what they call Secundus Root. He was the grandson of Elihu, and not he was on the light side. So I was sent over. Mr. Wick sent me over to John Harlan as an assistant, and I was working with Harlan that spring. This was before the Republican convention.
Spring of 52 then.
Yes, the spring of 1952.
Okay.
I was an assistant of John Harlan's, and not really much was being uncovered, but I became very, very fond of John Harlan, and we, I guess, became fairly close. And so the time came when Eisenhower was elected president. Then comes an interesting thing, because they designated, first of all, Herb Brownell became the Attorney General, and Bill Rogers was right under him. And then what he had to do is designate United States attorneys in the different districts, particularly the southern and the eastern districts of New York. In the southern district, he designated Eddie Lombard, who was a very much of a Dewey man, strong Dewey man. And in the eastern district, it was Leonard Moore, who was a neighbor of ours over in Brooklyn, and whom I've always known as a boy. And so when Leonard Moore was designated, immediately designated me as his assistant.
So you worked for Mr. Moore then?
I worked for Leonard Moore. And then, we went into the U.S. Attorney's Office. My father had told me to go there and try cases. Don't go there and shuffle papers. But when all of the new assistants, new Republican assistants, were gathered together in the Eastern and the Southern District. We were gathered together in a grand jury room, and in came Governor Dewey. And Governor Dewey gave us this advice. He said, "You're here to try cases. You're not here looking for a job or be on a payroll or anything like that. You're here to try cases, get a bit of a reputation, getting to know how things work." And then he said, after 2 years, get out. He said, don't spend more than 2 years, or you'll turn the U.S. Attorney's Office into something like the District Attorney's Office, which is loaded down with old soldiers who are really nothing better than desk sergeants who talk the vernacular of, you know, the criminal law, and they never get to be anything better. But just get in for 2 years. But he said if you're working on something of particular significance, stay on for another year. But he said 3 years is the maximum. And so that very much was on my mind. I went in and did what he said and also what my father urged. I got to know the agencies, the particular ones, narcotics, FBI, Secret Service, and the Treasury. We had a, I gave them good, fast service, very effective service, got their cases before grand juries. If the cases needed any brushing up or things had to be fixed up, I did that in the grand jury. If it looked as if it was a lousy case and never would really fly, I got a no true bill from the grand jury and got rid of the goddamn thing. So the different agencies got more to cluster into my office, the agents. Now the narcotics fellows were, well, in the first place there was a case to try. There was a man, what the hell was his name? There was a corruption trial, a fellow who was putting in sores. And he, and so how do you deal with that in the federal courts? And what we did, we got him indicted. I got him indicted for income tax evasion, and I tried that case.
Right.
And so that was, he was convicted, and that was, that was that. But the narcotics fellows, at that time, believe it or not, the country was relatively tolerant on this subject. They were at best ambivalent. The judges were ambivalent. It was, we had just come out of prohibition, and it was sort of, and cocaine was something that was fashionable. And so the narcotics agents were not having too much success in pressing their cases. I, on the other hand, picked up their cause. They told me what narcotics did to the vast run of people, not the people who might sniff a little something or other, but the average person who got hooked on it and then had to go out and steal and hold up in order to get money to pay the narcotics dealer. And there was a sort of that area of the addicted element of society that the narcotics agents focused me on, and I became their strong ally. In fact, it was said that I personally declared war on narcotics. Well, that was long before anybody else really had, or a bit before. But at any rate, I worked closely with them, and when their first group of cases came along, we did the best we could. They were always looking for higher ups, and the big higher ups was Charles Lucky Luciano, who had gone back to Italy before he could be convicted. And I think Governor Dewey might have been a little bit tarnished there, but at any rate, Luciano was the guy who was supposed to be the kingpin over in Europe, organizing the shipments.
Right.
And well, the first group that came around, we didn't get very far up, but then we worked on that. And the next group, I worked very hard in the grand jury to try to get some higher ups, and the rumored kingpin was Luciano's right hand man, was a fella, Eddie Sandello.
Right.
Sandello.
Right.
So Sandello was the fellow they were all trying to get, but he was very clever, always managed to see that he was not anywheres touching anything hot. And so we had no success at that time around with Sandello. But the second time, because we pressed, we got lots of the semi-higher-ups, a lot of the big, a lot of the organization. And so the net result was that the organization was thrown into some chaos. And also, the agents had lots of people that were, because I would make sure if there was somebody, a dealer that they really wanted to press, I made sure that he got a good heavy sentence. And so that the agents had were able to talk to those fellows and say, you know, these Wendells is absolutely death on you people, and let's see if we can't work something out. So little by little, the agents in those years had areas in which they were getting information, informants and whatnot. And as a result of this second big indictment, as I say, the organization was in chaos, and they heard, lo and behold, that there was some, that they had some stash that was coming in, and they didn't know what to do with it, and that they thought it would wind up in an apartment in Queens. We got three agents into that apartment, and they were in there, and then they heard some, it was a walk up, they heard somebody walking up the steps. Now they all ducked away, and the door opened, and in came a man with a gun. And they jumped him. And lo and behold, it was Eddie Sandello. So this was a big thing for them. And that happened toward the end of my tour of duty to Governor Dewey's 2 years. But they grabbed Eddie Sandello, and so that was that.
Well, you went into before your tour duty was over, you got into the Tellier case, I guess, that really seemed to make your career to some extent. The uranium.
Yes. This is what brought me together with the SEC. I'll lead up to that pretty soon.
Yeah, okay.
Next, the FBI. They were working largely on hijacking cases. And again, it was a question of how the hijackers were able to fence their stuff out, who the fences were and who was financing them and all of that. They could grab a truckload of coffee beans or something, but then the hijackers had to get rid of it. And so there was a lot of grand jury stuff in there to try to get into the upper echelons of fences. And then the question was money. I began to get into the money laundering problem. And so the FBI was, as I say, getting to know me extremely well, and so was the grand jury, and the grand jury was getting to know the FBI very well. And then all of a sudden there was a bank robbery out on Long Island. The Floral Park branch of the Franklin National Bank. A single gunman walked into that branch in August 1953. And he walked in and he made out with almost $200,000. It was the first time there had been a bank robbery in many, many years in the United States. It was something quite novel. And there was, the FBI had no clues at all, at least so it seemed. He walked in, he had his switch car arranged and went from one car to another and disappeared. One lone gunman. And then one agent of the FBI, a fellow named Jerry Van Dorn, he persistently checked fingerprints because in the switch car, there was a thumbprint on the rearview mirror. And by one thumbprint, they picked up a fellow down in Florida who was a car salesman. Yeah. His name was Pat McKinney. And so they arrested him, and McKinney was shipped up to Brooklyn. To me, the FBI by that time had gotten a good working relationship with me, so he was shipped directly from Florida to me. And we immediately began to work on it with a grand jury. Now, McKinney had a very decent side to him, and that is he had a new little wife, and she was a nice Catholic girl. And it was, we were able to, somehow or other, she had, at one time, had possession of some of the money, and spent some money, or spending some money, and couldn't explain it. So we had this on her. But McKinney was trying desperately to protect her. And so McKinney agreed to testify before the grand jury. And then over an extended period of time, several grand jury sessions, he told this story about a man named Ronald Martin, a very good-looking boy, who had befriended a person working for the bank named Cliff Oberkirk. And Cliff Oberkirk was the auditor for the bank, and little Cliff was gay and was taken very much with Ron Martin. And then Rod Martin and McKinney would go out with the three of them would go out together, and the little gay was fascinated, you know, by these strong arm guys, these very macho guys. And so they were planning a robbery of this bank, and then they staked it all out. They figured out a date to do it. Cliff gave them also detailed information as to everybody in the bank when they came and when they left and when there'd be a lot of money in the bank. And so they had it all prepared that Ronnie Martin and Pat McKinney were going to go into the bank. And just so to get themselves ready for it, they held up a couple of Howard Johnsons with their guns, and they pistol whipped the customers and so forth, just because they were all hyped up like that. And then came the time when they were to go into the bank, and Ronnie Martin got appendicitis, and he went into the hospital out there. Pat McKinney was all set to go, and so he went in anyway alone and pulled off the robbery that they had planned so carefully. He left the robbery, went up to the hospital to see Ronnie Martin, because he was afraid that Ronnie Martin was going to start talking. And just as he walked in, Ronnie Martin was in the hospital bed, and they were listening to all the news reports of this bank robbery. So Ronnie said to him, "I see you've been busy." And so it was agreed that Ronnie would meet Pat, and then the money would be split, and little Cliff Oberkirk would get his little share. So all of this came out in the grand jury, and it was a very glamorous case, and I spelled it all out in the indictment bit by bit by bit, so that it was sort of a fantastic story, and the grand jury loved it, and they... and so forth. So Pat McKinney was indicted, and Ronnie Martin, although when the robbery took place he was in the hospital, he was indicted too, and he was eventually convicted, and he was like so many really good looking kids. He had a little fierce mother, and she was a little fire, you know, dragon of a lady, and she wouldn't let him plead guilty or anything like that, but I took him to trial and he was convicted. So that was the end of Ronnie Martin. And that was the sort of the big thing I had with the FBI, and it was going on and all this time. And so at this time, around in the middle of all of this, into my office walked two extraordinary government employees. One was named Tim Callahan and the other Edward C. Yeagerman. And their history was unique. Tim Callahan came from a family, an upper crust Irish Catholic family in Boston. And he had gone to Andover and he went to Yale, where he was on Walter Camp's all-time All-American football team. He played the center of every Yale football game. He was like this. He was big. He was big and was right there in the center of the line. And on the other hand, he was as gentle and as sweet as he could be. He was an extremely, extremely sensitive person. I've never known anybody quite so sensitive. He loved the opera. He particularly loved the ballet. He loved traveling and he loved art, and he dressed very, very nicely. But he was huge, and he was this all-American center of the Yale football team. That was Tim. And no, Timmy, because he was in this category, was very close to the similar people in Boston, particularly the Fitzgerald family. And he got to know he and Rose Fitzgerald were sort of mated up at dinner parties and all the rest of the stuff when she was coming out and going to dances. Joe Kennedy was more rough and tumble, sort of wasn't really in this inner circle, but Timmy Callahan was right there, and I was very close to Rose. Eddie Yang, and so when Joe Kennedy became the first chairman of the SEC, Tim Callahan was his first appointment to the staff. How did Eddie Yeagerman get on the staff? Felix Frankfurter in the 30s went around trying to get Ivy League types, intellectual types, and lure them to Washington. Right. And he came across Eddie Yeagerman, a brilliant student at Yale. And so Eddie Yeagerman was put on the staff of the SEC. Now, there's one thing I have to jump back a little bit. As I was saying, I was very sort of busy in the federal court in New York, and along came an extraordinary lawyer named John Burns. And he had business in the court, and it was no time at all, because somehow or other he got run into my office for one reason or other, and was chit-chatting and comparing ideas. And John Burns had a little law firm. And I think he had five or six people. And he was, I suppose, you know, when you've got a smart Irishman, he is really smart. And that was John Burns. And Joe Kennedy picked him up. He was out of Boston. Joe Kennedy picked him up when he was a young man, just out of Harvard, and almost immediately made him a judge in Boston. And then he said, no, I got better ideas for you. And John Burns set up a law firm, and he represented Joe Kennedy. And he had a house in the middle of the Kennedy compound out on Cape Cod. And tutored the Kennedy boys to get them into Harvard, and while they were in Harvard and all the rest of that. John Burns was an indispensable part of Joe Kennedy's entourage. So when Joe Kennedy became the chairman of the SEC, John Burns was general counsel, put right in there as general counsel. So that is John Burns. Now, John Burns, when he was around getting to know me, he was making plans with me that I should get out of the government, because I was thinking, Dewey said, get out after 2 years or 3 years and go back and practice law. And so I had that in the back of my mind. And John Burns said what he never really had was a partner, a real partner. And he figured that he and I would really build this firm and make it big. He had all the Kennedy business, but he also had all the Grace business. He had who was that big guy in newspapers and everything? Hughes.
Gannett? Gannett?
No, back in those days.
Hearst.
He had the Hearst family, the whole William Randolph Hearst operations, and a lot of other things. He had fantastic business, but somehow or other, he never found somebody he would like to practice with. And the big law firms, he knew what I found out, that you just go into them and they're stultifying. They want to take what you've got. They don't want, and that's about it. So John Burns and I had planned that I would leave the Department of Justice and go into practice with him. Then lo and behold, John Burns dropped dead. So that was the end of that. And his firm struggled along. The six or seven lawyers got down to five, got down to three, and then later on, you get old and feeble. Hey, let me give you some. The remnants of his firm was sort of dwindling. And then I heard later on that he and Joe Kennedy fell apart, but he was still crucial to the family. He was right there in the middle of the family compound and crucial to the boys and so forth. So that was that. Now, around this time, as I say, Yeagerman and Callahan walked into the office, and they started to talk to me about these boiler rooms, and they were sort of an independent roving team at the SEC, and they put together some criminal cases, but the SEC wouldn't give them a criminal reference report, they chose the first one to be against the number one over-the-counter dealer of dealer in unlisted stocks named Walter Tellier. And they chose a case involving bonds, Alaska telephone bonds. And Eddie Yeagerman, being a real intellectual, figured out that the way the bonds were sold, they said there were four series of bonds, and they'd sell one series, and then they'd sell the next series, and the next series they'd sell people because they were paying dividends on the first, and then the next, and the next, and they were at the last series, and they were running out of money. And Timmy Callahan's great forte was lining up victim witnesses. And he could start telling you about victim witnesses, and you couldn't help but cry, because it was so horrible how they were swindled out of their money. So this was their case. There was a case of telephone salesmen. The trouble with the commission was, they said, how can you prove Tellier is a big shot? He's one of the major figures in Wall Street, and all these people are salesmen, and he can say he's got nothing to do with the salesmen and this and that and so forth. They were thinking of a million reasons to duck away. At this time, so they ducked away on this Alaska telephone case. At this time, the uranium stocks were beginning to become the public notice. And we're now getting into, let's see, what year? Oh, this is 55. This is spring of 55. And the uranium stocks and some of these people, of the telephone salesmen, were coming to the attention of Congress. So they asked the commission about that, and Sink Armstrong said, well, there could be several of these boiler rooms, and we're watching them, but there's nothing serious, it's not very big, and so forth. And it was kind of brushed aside. But then, out of clear blue sky, we came up with an indictment in the Alaska telephone case, which was had headline news in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and not to mention the News, the Post, all the other newspapers, that this was big time stuff. Now, this is against a backdrop of really quiescent activity in the securities market. People were still felt burned from the Great Depression. There wasn't this gambling money that was just being induced out into the market again. So it was against that backdrop, and this is to be said, I think, by way of explanation for the commission, because it was they were sitting on a market of in which very few issues. There were no issues, no new issues, nothing, no action, no real activity. And so they, at any rate, Sink had said that there wasn't a serious problem, and then he woke up in the news in the morning and read these things in the newspapers, and all of a sudden everybody was full of it.
Now, Armstrong is the chairman of the SEC?
Yes, Jay Sinclair Armstrong.
Sinclair, yes, okay. You're calling him
Call Sink. Me Sink, he said to the okay. reporters.
All right.
A lovely fellow, a very honorable fellow. So this thing was going on, and Congress was after him, and he was in New York, and he asked to visit me. He came over to my office at the U.S. Attorney's office, and we talked for quite a while. I told him, frankly, what the Alaska telephone case was, and he said, how do you expect to prove it? And I said, I can prove it because these people were saying these salesmen were saying the same thing, and I can prove that they were all operating out of one place, and that also the lawyer who gave the legal advice to get the Alaska telephone issue going was a former SEC attorney, and when I confronted him with all of this, he did it on the basis of Reg A exemption, because that's $400,000 a year. And so each one of these issues was just $400,000. And this fellow, obviously, he wasn't used to being pulled before grand juries, but when I pulled him before a grand jury, he collapsed and admitted that he had told them, that he had told the promoters of this whole thing it was nothing but a Ponzi, and not to do it again. So based upon that, that was our criminal case. I explained that to Sink, and then I said, we're about to go on another, and it's much, much bigger. It's huge. It's the uranium stocks. And we have five or six of these boiler rooms who are touting these uranium stocks. And he was sitting there talking to me, and then he asked me if I would be interested in becoming the regional administrator in New York. And so I thought about that, and I was very much attracted to it. I had a very large staff, and I was very impressed because going with the SEC, it was a very prestigious organization and all of that. And so I called him later and said, yes, I would be interested, and he put it to the other commissioners, and they so designated me the regional administrator. So I resigned from the Department of Justice, and then it was a lot of goodbye sort of stuff. The Grand Jury Association gave me a great big flag staff with a silken flag and an eagle's on the top of it, and I had it sent over to my new office. I was attracted by the idea that here was a big staff of people that I would have, and getting into a slightly different line of activity. And then a few of the narcotics agents asked to have supper with me, so they mentioned some little restaurant down in the village, and I went in there, and there was the whole organization, everybody from Washington. The place was packed, and they presented me with Eddie Sandello's gun, which is up here on the wall, which I put on my wall at the SEC, which caused people to call me Pistol Paul. And that's how all that started.
Didn't you wrap up the uranium case mostly, though, while you were still in the...
Yes, we had it. That indictment came down just as I was deciding whether, you know, what to do. And I had discussed it with Sink. I told him something very big is coming along. And I'll have to do that before I give you my answer. But the uranium case was all wrapped up. And, in fact, I had gone out there to the area, the mining area, and spoken to lots and lots of people, lined up a lot of witnesses. I went up there with Tim and Eddie. Gee, how they love to travel around. And so
had anybody gone after penny stocks before at this point?
No, because the explanation is that the market, that the country was so, that they felt it was, that they were not... They were sort of not sensitive to the problem. And it was the same way that they were more or less on narcotics. It took a while before they were really given a good shaking and made to realize that lots of people were enslaved by these narcotics, and so by what they call a controlled substance. But when Tim Callahan was explaining what happens to people when the pitch is made to them about investment, penny stocks and things like that, you get the feeling that money, this stuff should be a controlled substance too, because people become virtually helpless. I think that, you see, Sink had lived in a world... The SEC lived in a world in which it was all very nice little technical problems dealing with, you know, big issues and proxy statements and whatnot, big investment banks. But then they, I'll get to some of the witnesses when time comes for me to go back to Brooklyn and try the Talia case, because I went over to New York and the commission was, they couldn't have been nicer. They couldn't have been better. And so I had a good staff. The head of the staff then was a fellow named Willie Moran. He was a real old-timer there in their office, and there were a number of others who were really excellent people. But Timmy came in, and right off the bat, what we did was organize raids on these boiler rooms. And there must have been 8 or 10 of them that we hit. And the New York office was used to, when they're making a broker-dealer inspection, of knocking on the door and coming in and presenting credentials and looking at whether or not the books and records and everybody was all those people working there were properly registered. Not Timmy Callahan. He had a whole group of fellows with him. He walked up to where the place was. Somebody, I think, once said they were about to knock. No, go away. He put his foot on the door and bang, pushed the door in and walked right in. He said, "I want the openers over here on this side of the room. I want the loaders there. I want the reloaders here. And I'll find out who the dynamiters are. I'll get to you, but you better come over here early. Otherwise, I'll find you eventually." So it was the openers, the loaders, the reloaders, and the dynamiters. That was the way these salesmen were categorized.
Okay. And they knew what he was talking about right away, so they followed orders, I guess. Huh?
Yes.
Huh.
That was a, so this was the commissions, these sales, these staff members we had at first, they were bug-eyed, they were really astonished, but then they joined right in the thing, and I got to know them and got to work with them, and they got me, well, the first place, the commission, we was in the commission so steadily that there was no point in traveling to Washington anymore. They put a speaker right on the commission table, and we would present our case to them, and the cases were all handled. What we wanted to do was get closed down places as fast as we could. Now, that initial surge was more enforcement activity than the commission had had since its inception, and so that, as I say, it's not exactly a fair comparison because of there hadn't been such activity. But at any rate, there it was, and Tim Callahan and Eddie Yeagerman, were really broken open for them, and they were regular staff members of the commission. So that was that. Now, as I say, I got to know the people in New York and developed a great respect for them. And one of the things, most of the people coming in to the New York office had been on the street. And there was a ticker tape in Washington, and we both had the broad tape, New York and Washington, but there was a ticker tape in Washington, but not one in New York. So I established one in New York so we could watch the tape, and that paid real dividends because they were able to spot a lot of the manipulations just by looking at it and knowing, you know, who's hitting the market at the end of this and that. These fellows, these academics in Washington, the ticker tape didn't talk to them. I don't know why they had it. But these fellows in New York who had been on the street, the ticker tape did speak to them. And so we made a number of cases just based upon that, those fellows watching it, leading eventually to this last case, that inside information case. So now, let's see where that.
Well, I've got some questions.
Sure.
I want to touch on.
It's about time you did some talking.
Well, not too much. Your predecessor, he went to the commission. Is that right?
Yeah.
Who was that again?
Jim Sargent.
And what did you see when you came in to taking over the New York Regional Office that you felt that you wanted to change or you wanted to rework a little bit?
Well, the first thing I did really is organize these teams to burst into these boiler rooms, and that went on for a good while because we're on the telephone constantly back with the commission, initiating administrative proceedings to knock these rooms out of business, and get into court on the subjects of salesmen and get material going over to the U.S. Attorney's office. It's just initiating a lot of stuff.
Right.
Because I think, really, they were just there like that. Now, Jim, well, I don't know. Jim Sargent was there because he got a job in the.
He'd been around a while, I guess.
Yes.
There was something that came up pretty early in your tenure too, or that I noticed, which was an idea to get federal, state, and industry people together and come up with a code of conduct or something
well,
like that.
You see, that sort of thing was being spun by really these local district attorneys and the New York State Attorney General. It was a Jack Chavez. He wanted to get into the act because they were reading this was where the action was. And so they were constantly sort of calling meeting, and I was for it, but you get different agencies together to get some sort of a code, and nothing much can come of that. You've got to have your own notion of where the your own notion of standards. Now, what they so some of these, where are the things I have here on?
Well, and the code wouldn't do much good unless people knew that there was one of these teams that's going to come and break their door down, I guess.
Well, I think that sort of thing is always sort of spread around. But really, the SEC has in the position to dominate it. And to start getting involved in cooperative action with other people, it isn't going to work. Now, several, as we go on, particularly in the Lowell Burrell case, the district attorney moved in on that. We gave him the whole case, and that was that. That is the way Burrell, he just picked up our investigation and the stuff we've set forth in court. And then I got an indictment, and my attitude was, well, so let him go his way.
How did you come up with Lowell Burrell? Where did you find him?
Now let me. This is the Burrell thing. Was Wilson. Alvida. A.C. Gray, Chesler.
I seem to recall him being one of the first cases.
This is Guterma. Yes, it is one of the first.
Might be in here.
Right. This is Talia. I had to, in the midst of all this, I had to go back and try the Talia case. Where the hell is that? Because back in the U.S. Attorney's Office, they tried it and got a hung jury. And this was the only indictment I ever found in which it didn't result in a conviction. Hmm. And so Leonard Moore was about to go on the Second Circuit. And so he got me designated a... Here we are, Swanfinch. Here we are. And he has a special assistant. So I went back and I tried the Talia case.
So while you're in the SEC,
While I was in the SEC, I went back and tried the Talia case, the Alaska telephone case. And there, of course, I'll never forget, you know, Timmy Callahan, this huge fellow, rushing around, and his heart was giving out on him. And I was sort of young and wasn't really sensitive to how sick he was getting. But he lined up these victim witnesses, and the case was really victim witnesses. And there was one lady I can remember so well. She was a maiden lady, and she worked a foot press in a factory that made out rubber casting, hard rubber castings. She saved every penny she could so her niece could go to college, and so it was all saved. And that money was just taken away from him for this Alaska telephone case. So there was nothing there that she had for all this. She had to walk in and she was crippled because of it. And this is the sort of witness. Timmy got one after another of those, and we had about 20 or 30 of them. And finally the judge said, "Mr. Wendells, how many are we going to have?" And I said, "We're ready with hundreds, Your Honor." And so he said, "Well, let's see if we can... We'll cut across." Well, I was glad to have him calling across. But then when the thing was given to the jury, I think the jury was going to jump out of the box and going to hang, tell you. They were so furious about it. And so the case like this has to be made, you know, on the business of the victim witnesses.
You tugged at the heartstrings.
Yes.
And, you know.
You try it as if it's an intellectual challenge.
Yeah.
Now, Eddie solved that business for this business of it being a Ponzi. And we solved the Ponzi proof by breaking the back of this lawyer, a former SEC lawyer who was their counsel. And so he came in and testified that that when they said they wanted to go with another deal, he says, you can't do it, it's a Ponzi. So we had that one, that part of the case won, and the rest of it was strictly with victim witnesses, whereas the office who traded after I left, they got into a big tangle about what is the hell is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it was they approached it the wrong way around. So
Lowell Burrell has got this company, Swan Finch, that he's buying all kinds of.
Well, let's see. Well,
how did this come to your attention?
Swan Finch was already the. We had informed the SEC that there was that based upon. You see, by the staff going in, the great thing that happened by them going in and hitting the state in the street this way, they had all sorts of new sources of information.
Okay.
And they had information to the effect that Swan Finch was being merchandised out into the market. And so then, based upon that, we went to Swan Finch. They hadn't filed reports. And Lowell Burrell hadn't, and Lowell Burrell couldn't be found, and so we got a hold of Lowell Burrell, and we served papers on Lowell Burrell to come in and testify and say, tell us what is going on in Swan Finch. Now here is the way he set up the deal. He was a very sophisticated New York lawyer, and he. He would have three or four interrelated companies that he controlled. Swan Finch, which was the principal thing, but he used that to buy control of other companies, and then they'd begin to issue stock back and forth. Swan Finch stock would be issued for the assets of another company, and the SEC had a rule that if you issue stock to get the assets of another company, it doesn't have to be registered. So Lowell Burrell was well aware of that, and he had a big supply of stock. Then the next thing the SEC had never really touched was what happened if you pledged the stock for a loan, you default on the loan, and then the money lender sells out. So they funnel these distributions through money lenders, and. So it was coming out. Now, Burrell did was put people, he had an Admiral Callahan as his sort of fellow. I got a bench warrant out for Burrell because he didn't appear to give us, to testify. And then he took off. He had a home in Brazil. And the thing about Brazil is, that I had gotten to know, was that it didn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. So you could go there and you could laugh at everybody. And so Burrell took off. Admiral Callahan was left holding the bag. He had a number of sort of seemingly prestigious people he left behind and to try to say, oh, we can't we don't know what happened, we can't file the reports and all the rest of the stuff, but we deny any knowledge of any of this stuff. And so Burrell took off, and that was the end of Burrell. So then finally we got Burrell back because of this bench warrant. And then the district attorney of New York came in and indicted Burrell. And so when he did that, I didn't bother going over to the U.S. attorney or anything like that. We just left that with him. It was Frank Hogan. Mm-hmm. He succeeded Dewey as district attorney. And he was a good example of somebody who shouldn't be around as an enforcement district attorney for too long, because he was just there forever, and he had his gang of men, and so they were all very loyal and one thing or another, but So it goes.
How about this Arvida? Arthur Vining
Right.
Sounds like another one of your pretty slick New
this
York...
This was very much coming out of the New York office. And again, it was... there it is. We're now talking about 1958. And... they were, at this time, I was being criticized by a lot of people in saying that I'm treating people in the securities industry. Well, I guess it was when I got into Arvida, I was treating people in the securities industry, but really in the tenure, as if they were gunmen. And I said that I know of some gunmen, and I was thinking particularly of Pat McKinney, who had to go to jail, but he was a stand-up fellow, but he did walk into a bank with a gun, and I said I would place him in my category, standard of people I would admire, or not least admire, as over some of these other people who sucked every last bit of savings out of some poor person, these con men. And so they began to call those fellows white-collar criminals. And so then white-collar crime became sort of a thing that people wander around New York today as lawyers claiming that they're white-collar crime as specialists. Well, now let's take Arvida. And again, as a result of the fact, see, part of the problem in the New York office is that those fellows had never been out down on the street except to check on bookkeeping problems in brokerage offices. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have a connection of people down on the street they could say that they could talk to frankly and pick up gossip and rumors and the rest of that. They were out of touch, so to speak. They were people who had come from the street, but they were out of touch of the street because they had sort of an SEC academic attitude about their regulatory responsibilities. They didn't have a like the narcotics agents and the FBI. They use one case not only to break the case, but they use it to get lots of new connections, lots of people they can talk to. Well, Arvida, what happened there? There was a very wealthy American, Arthur Vining Davis, who was the head of the Aluminum Company of America for many, many years, and he invested his money in Florida real estate. And he amassed a big bundle of it. And Florida real estate was beginning to come back. It was beginning to look exciting. And so was announced, I think it was out of Loeb Rhodes. Came out of Loeb Rhodes. But Dominic, a very social firm with impeccable connections to Switzerland, was in it too. And this was their first big merchandising securities this was the first big securities distribution out of Loeb Rhodes and Dominic. Dominic wouldn't have been in this particular anyway, but Loeb Rhodes was much in it. Loeb Rhodes was headed by John Loeb, a very significant person on Wall Street and in New York and all over.
So they're selling shares in Florida real estate. Are they selling shares in Florida real estate? Is that what this was?
Here's what happened. They got together and they decided that there was going to be a distribution of shares in a holding company of Florida real estate. That was the concept. But what did they do? They held a press conference and said that was what they were going to do. And then they were preparing a registration statement and said they were. But it hadn't even been filed. And they held a press conference who said this is what they proposed to do. So then what happened was brokerage firms all over town were taking indications of interest and to subscribe to this. Oh. And there had never had been an effective registration statement. So the whole issue was spoken for. And more than that, the aftermarket was spoken for before the registration statement was filed. So I brought this to the attention of the commission. It was one of those things. I was speaking to them. They were at their table, and they had their microphone. And Barney Woodside had a Corp Finn, of course. Corp Finn was very, very much concerned about this, because registration statements, that was their world. That basically is where it all starts. This is the registration of securities subject to a distribution. And so here, what was going on, and I told them what was going on, the distribution had been made, was already finished, and they hadn't yet filed anything. So I asked for authority to go into court and get an injunction. I went into court, and I charged the Low Bros and Dominic with selling unregistered securities and misrepresentations in selling them. And so, of course, Low Bros and Dominic were sort of couldn't believe that they were being hauled into court by Pistol Paul, as if they were running a boiler room or anything like that, and loud with the screams. And they sort of circulated the rumor that here I was off on a thing of myself, my own, a frolic and banter of my own, and that the SEC, these great minds, Bonnie Woodside and L. Manny Cohen back in Washington, they weren't party to this. Mm. Now, I don't know where they were getting their information, but we got, they had, as I say, the most prestigious lawyers you can conceive of out there in court accusing me of really reckless conduct and so forth. But nevertheless, I got a preliminary injunction in the district court. What did they do? They found a circuit court judge, Eddie Lombard, and they got Eddie Lombard to reverse it. Then I moved to have it then brought on before the whole Second Circuit. So then the big showdown came, and it went on before the whole Second Circuit. My analogy was the way the Indians used to hunt buffalo. They would start some sort of a forest fire or some sort of excitement, get the buffalo raging blindly in the direction of a narrow pass, and that's where they'd be waiting for the slaughter. And so that was the analogy I used. And I'm trying to think. Well, at any rate, this fellow who used to be the chairman was out of the crevasse. He was there. He was getting a great laugh out of that. He knew exactly what was going on, and he knew. And he sort of, and some of the people in the street didn't mind seeing John Loeb having his comeuppance, and there was all that going on. But there was a big showdown before the Second Circuit, and Manny Cohen came up and stood right by me, and Manny Cohen, when he starts giving an academic or an intellectual analysis of all these security laws and what was behind them and the rest of the stuff, he is just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. He is fantastic. So I was here with my analogy of the Indian starting a stampede, but he, with all these hotshot lawyers from Wall Street who were ready to knock me off before the full Second Circuit, and by the time the two of us were through, why we were just through, they were finished. They were absolutely finished. Eddie Lombard, I think, had to agree with them.
So did Manny Cohen participate in the defense?
He were right there in the argument. He and I were right standing side by side.
Okay.
So that was Arvida, and it was a big deal. It was what they call in Corfin gun jumping. That selling an issue before a registration statement becomes final, and indeed before it even is really filed,
right.
and so these lowbrows and Dominic had just circumvented the SEC. This issue was sold absolutely, completely spoken for, and so was the aftermarket. People were placing orders in the aftermarket. And so we got them to join. We threw the whole blooming deal into a cocked hat, and that was that. So that was our Arvida. It was a great day for us and for Corp Fin. And when I remember when I told them that there was some question in the street as the extent to which the Home Office, I was discussing this case after Eddie Lombard had reversed the district judge. And I was speaking to the commission on the telephone, and what did Bonnie Woodside say? I said, there's a rumor, the feeling around here is that Washington isn't behind this, that this couldn't possibly be the Division of Corporation Finance. And that I thought it would be appropriate for Corp Fin to make itself its position, because Corp Fin was vehemently for me in this case. Their whole position in the scheme of things was destroyed by having people, you know, sell an issue even before a registration statement was effective or indeed filed. So I remember Bonnie Woodside in the back. I could hear him growl in the background. He says, "Losing your guts, Paul." I said, "No, I just wonder whether you have any guts, Bonnie." And so Bonnie did. Woodside didn't show, but Manny Cohen was there.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that was a little...
There's an implication, though, that some of the more prestigious firms were a little surprised that the SEC actually came out and didn't just lay down for something like this. I mean, it sounds like you surprised them a little bit.
Well, the prestigious firms were all in court. Every wise guy, securities lawyer, was there in the Second Circuit.
Yeah.
All the big shots, and they all felt that somehow or other they all knew more about what the law was than I do. They kept telling me, they say, "You really don't understand the law on this and that and so forth and so on. There's this interpretation and that interpretation." And I said, "All I'm interested in is the reality, what happened. I'm interested in how the Indians hunted buffalo, and I'm interested in the way these fellas got this panic going with saying, hot issue, big issue, you better get in fast." And they had about 5 or 10 other houses, member firms, who were taking indications of interest. So the thing was sold. It was completely sold. I reported to the commission, "This issue has been sold."
Well, somebody less prestigious, but probably way more interesting. Can you tell me when you first heard about Sandy Guterma and heard about what he was doing?
Oh, I don't.
Guterma.
Oh, yes. All right. A very interesting thing. Let me...
Quite a contrast from Arthur Vining Davis.
Yes. Gutsy Guterma. And a fantastic story. This thing is all there. Where do I have the file on Gutsy? Most, this is Wilson. There we go. Gotama followed the, to some extent, follow the Lowell Burrell pattern. He got a hold of a listed company, F.L. Jacobs. And then F.L. Jacobs went hard at work picking up other companies, Bon Ami, United Dyes, Scranton Lace, Symphonics Electric, Hal Roach Studios. And with all of these companies, he would, once he controlled them, he would say to them, I'm going to issue you United, I'm going to issue United Dyes stock, and United Dyes stock, and or F.L. Jacobs. I'll issue you F.L. Jacobs, and you issue me others. You issue your stock, and of course, they were, he controlled both ends of it, and he was able to get the thing put on the books, of which United Dyes stock and the F.L. Jacobs stock were all given a very exaggerated level. So that gave them book value that they never really legitimately had, but it also gave Gutama a big pile of stock, not only in F.L. Jacobs. Oh, wait a minute, I'll talk about United Dye with. Oh, yes, in F.L. Jacobs, but in Bon Ami, Scranton Lakes, and everything else. So then he had all this stock, and the next thing was, how do you get it merchandised? Because you have to move it out onto the market. And again, he went to the moneylenders, and he got moneylenders to lend money based upon this stock, all different issues of stock. And so that way he brought cash into his empire, and he got the stock in the hand of the moneylenders, and he had companies that he controlled, which then began to merchandise it. So put it out over the telephone and one way or another. And in these companies,
and these were boiler rooms, these merchandise companies.
A lot of them, yes, virtually boiler room operations.
Okay.
Because I think that Gutama had a reputation as being a real wizard and all the rest of it, and he nevertheless was regarded with some suspicion because nobody knew exactly where the hell he had come from. He was born in Siberia, went to China, went to the Philippines, came up through the Hawaiian Islands, jumped ship a couple of times, smuggled onto other ships and in and out, and finally wound up on Wall Street. And I think it's some of these very dubious foreign little caches of money that got him started. But once he got started, he was then rolling. And he followed the Lowell Burrell technique. He had, he hired all kinds of, you know, there were always people walking around who want to be on a board of directors. They want to be a president of a company. They want to be this, they're lawyers who want to represent. So Gutama had a whole collection of these people. And then he was involved in merchandising the stock, and the stock was appearing in the market. My people picked up the fact that there's a lot of this stock that is coming along. And so we looked in, we found none of these companies had been filing their reports. And so we went to F.L. Jacobs. They didn't, they They hadn't filed any reports, and they had people back there supposedly running it, a listed company, and they didn't. Guterma had resigned from them, and they said, "Well, we don't have the records. We can't give you a report." And then the question is, what do you do with a listed company that whose stock is traded publicly, and they think their internal affairs are so chaotic that they can't come together with a report? They can't come up with a responsible report. So what did I do? I moved to have a receiver appointed, and this was unprecedented, completely unprecedented. And as all the Wall Street lawyers pointed out, that the SEC had specific authority in the area of mutual funds, investment companies, when a company is insolvent, when they declare insolvency, to have a receiver appointed. But here, they hadn't declared insolvency. They weren't investment companies. They weren't anything like that. And I move for the appointment of a receiver. And all the big shots from Wall Street jumped on me. I wanted receivers in all of these companies, and they said, there is no precedent for it, and it's a very dangerous thing. You can, with that authority, you can walk in on anybody and get a receiver. Just because he fails to file a report, you take his company away and have a receiver. And I said, under these circumstances. Then what happened? I get worried that Guterma and his sidekick, a man named Everly, had tickets to go to fly to Turkey. And I had this business of Lowell Burrell very much in my mind, because after a while we were just frustrated by the fact that Burrell absented himself. And so I swore out warrants for their arrest. And I got my friends over there in the U.S. Marshal's office to execute the warrants, and they picked up Guterma and Everly as they were about to get on a plane. So we had them under arrest, and he then launched out with a very virulent attack on me and said that I was just off a crusader, a crazy crusader, and this and that and so forth and so on. And all of his problems were caused because of me, and I was destroying these companies. But then, but little by little, we got to know more and more about these companies. The judge at first refused to give us receiver, Judge Sugarman, because he was very much impressed by all these other lawyers who came in from Wall Street, and he refused to give us a receiver. But then, as we began to close in on him and got more and more information, he then began to lose his faith in these other lawyers, and he agreed to appoint a committee of three outsiders to go in and advise the court as to what the situation was. And the outsiders, I knew all three of them, and they all three said, it's absolutely chaotic. And nobody knows whether the company's bankrupt, this, that, or the other thing. At that time, Sugarman completely collapsed. We got a receiver. We went in there, and every one of these companies had just been, or the assets were just scooped out of them. And so that was the end of Gutsy Guterma.
So he was hoping to take the assets with him.
Sure, he had a lot of them. And again, this business of wash sales, you know, money was flowing out of these companies to these foreign bank accounts. Mm-hmm. We had Guterma here in custody, and we were never going to let go of him until we got all that money back. So that was Guterma and F.L. Jacobs. I guess the significant thing was that we got a receiver in a company for an issuer that said whose affairs were so chaotic they couldn't file the reports. Now let's see. Are there any others but particularly...
Well, the interesting thing is that you've
for
got...
Wilson. That's an interesting okay. case.
And this would have been a little earlier on, I guess.
This was in 58, getting the... It was June of 58, yes. The first time the Wall Street Journal ever had a photograph, and it was on page one, and it was of me.
was wow.
Louis Wolfson. Louis Wolfson was something of a folk hero, sort of a Robin Hood. He was an outsider who would make raids on companies, and he had put on a control fight, which he lost for Merrill Chapman and Scott Montgomery Ward. And even under some of the staff people of the SEC, the lawyers, people down in Washington, Wilson was something of a folk hero. He was kind of an outsider who was busting up this cabal that was running the country economically. So what happens was he announces a fight to gain control of American Motors. And American Motors was having some problem. They just didn't seem to know how to run their affairs. And Louis Wilson goes into the picture and begins to acquire stock. And he undoubtedly had a following, and that's where a bit of the sadness was and the hurt. And so our people, again, just because these fellows in the New York office, because they had been in these, making these cases, they were developing contacts on the street, so that if something was being sold, or there was a distribution going on, this or that was happening, they would pick up wind of it. And then when they got a little wind of it, we'd follow it up and find out what the heck was going on. So Wilson, it came to the time when a big showdown, Wilson supposedly had a big position in American Motors. And people who followed him, too, had quite a bit of stock. And there was a question as to whether or not he could grab it off. But then I think American Motors indicated things weren't going that well with it, and so Wilson must have gotten cold feet. And what does he do? He sells out his position secretly after he announces publicly that he had acquired this position and he was going for broke on this. He sells out his position, and all people go out on the street and find out he went short a huge block of stock. So we got a writ on Wilson. Authority to go into court on Wilson. Wilson had a guy who was his public spokesman, a man named Rittmaster. And Rittmaster was giving all of these statements particularly to the New York Times. The New York Times was really in a very, very embarrassing situation here, because Rittmaster had given a statement to the New York Times that Wilson, despite the fact that there was bad news, a little bit of bad news about American Motors, Wilson had greatest confidence in it, and he was going to gain control, and he had full confidence in taking over American Motors. This was on the published very prominently by in the New York Times. So at that time, by then we had found out that he had sold out all his stock, and that in fact he had gone short a big bundle, a huge bundle. So I took Wilson to court, and then the time came for a hearing in court, and Wilson was well represented in court, and the denying all these things. And then I called the New York Times was right in the middle, so I called on the reporter from the New York Times to testify on the oath. And into my oath came all the big shots from the Times, particularly their general counsel, who's a member of the family, the Adler family. And nice, you know, can't think of more respectable people, the people who are more horrified by all of this. And I was in a terrible dilemma, because I didn't particularly want to make a reporter from the New York Times report under oath as to where he got his story. He got his story from Rittmaster, but he wouldn't say it. And he didn't want to say it. And so these people were in my office in the hopes that I would quash the subpoena. I would withdraw the subpoena on their reporter. So they were all sitting in my office, this whole New York Times crowd, and all of the people from Law Day and Lord, which was there, very reputable law firm, and waiting. And so I said, get me Rittmaster on the telephone. And so I said, I just want to check on something. It's you who gave the story to the New York Times, isn't it? And so I guess all of a sudden he blurted out, yes, it was. I said, you don't have to the Times, but you go home, you don't have to worry. I got what I wanted to find, what I wanted to find out. So that was the end of that. And so Wilson was enjoined, and we put the whole business in our papers in court. And so Wall Street worked its revenge, because he was short a couple of 100,000 shares, but his people all over were left hanging. So Robin Hood had betrayed all the merry bunch, and Wall Street got a good chuckle out of it, I guess. And the Wall Street Journal had a big thing on page one, the first time they ever had somebody's picture in their paper. I'm surprised that it wasn't in the SEC file that they sent me. I don't keep those clippings, frankly, but so I didn't. But at any rate, there it was.
How about that? Well, that's
that was Louis Wilson. Now then, we've done Arvida, Louis Wilson, Gussie Gutterma. We can go sort of on and on, but there was a steady flow of these things coming in. The boiler room thing didn't end immediately, but I don't know, when the SEC went over to ask for their appropriation to Congress, I would go over with the SEC had a, this is so funny, you know, they had a van with two seats up front, and then in the back was a compartment. So we went over to Washington, to Capitol Hill, and in the two seats here would be people with all the financial records that they were leaving with a congressional committee to justify what they were asking for. And Sink and I sat in the back with our sticking our legs out. We were the only witnesses. Now there is one other rather interesting, I think, case. And that is, it was toward the end of my tenure, and we, and this was an example of the big payoff by having the ticker tape in the New York office, because I had people on that tape who really, as I said, the tape talked to them. It didn't talk to those, with all due deference, it didn't talk to those fellows in Washington, because they were academics, basically. But these guys, the ticker tape would talk to them. Now, K.B. Roberts was, let me see, a good place to start. I don't have the...
Curtis Wright.
Yeah. Good, thank you. Curtis Wright, a listed company. And there was they were a dividend-paying company. And they were down to have a director. There was going to be a director's meeting. It was reported in the Wall Street Journal. They always report when meetings are going to be held for dividends. And they were down to have a meeting to decide what to do about their dividend, whether or not they'd be able to hold it, or whether or not they were going to increase it, and all the rest. They had issued some fairly affirmative news. So Curtis Wright was selling a little bit on the strong side. But then came the announcement on the broad tape that the dividend had been cut, was cut completely, no dividend. And our fellas were watching it because they were prepared for this. They saw something like this was going to happen. And we all wanted to know what the trading was before the announcement. And the trading before the announcement was coming up a bit before was strong, and then before the announcement, big selling. So I took everybody in the office who could walk and sent them down on the street, and I said, find out who the sellers are. And we were back, and lo and behold, the sellers were all coming out of this one brokerage firm, member firm, K.D. Roberts. And I had another investigators walk right in on K.D. Roberts. And this was all the same afternoon, within hours of all of this. And I was on the phone to the commission. I said, I want to get to court right away. I'd like to get to court this afternoon. And so they assembled all their people. I told them what had happened, what I thought had happened. And the K.D. Roberts had sold a big bundle of stock. Then when we got into K.D. Roberts, we found not only did they sell everything that they had, but they went short a big bundle. So that's when I got on the phone to the SEC. And so the interesting thing was, obviously at the table they had Phil Loomis, who was the head of Trading Exchange. A very nice, very sort of altruistic and a very, very bright man, a bright, very bright lawyer.
Now, are you on your speakerphone?
I was on the speakerphone, so I could hear them all down there.
Okay.
And I had Willie Moran with me, and I had a bunch of the investigators, guys who were right up from the street, ready to pump it right into them where the selling was coming from. And so I said, where is the selling come from? It's all coming out of K.D. Roberts. And they checked with this firm, that firm, another firm, all over the street. And it was massive coming out of K.D. Roberts. So I said that I want to go to court right away. I told them what had happened. And I heard Phil Loomis exclaim, sitting there with the commission, whole commission, well, what's the matter with that, Paul? He thought, you know, it was the duty of a broker to find out what the inside information was. And you know, that was the, That was the traditional view of a broker's job. What's the matter with that, Paul? And so then the chairman, I think it was Ned Gadsby, growled out something. Just technically, we don't like to bother you, Paul, with little technical things like technical violations, but technicalities, but what's the violation? And Willie Moran was sitting right next to me. He didn't wait for them to finish the question. He said, 10B5. So that was that case.
So that's insider trading?
K.D. Roberts. So then what they did, here's what happened. The commission decided that this was much too novel for me to go into court on. And I think, because I would be going into court with just like the coming in, presenting to a district judge a completely new theory of violation. So they said, they were mumbling around amongst them. They said, we want to hold this, your application to go into court right away, but we're going to open an administrative proceeding on it, so it is of record. So you put the whole thing in the administrative proceeding, and on the court, we won't take a position on that. So I didn't go into court, but the administrative proceeding was started. And then nothing happened the remaining time in the administrative proceeding. They never put the thing on for a hearing, except they had all our papers. I mean, they didn't have to have a hearing. It was there. And then the new administration came in, Kennedy. So then the new chairman of the SEC, very fine man, Columbia law professor named Carey, Bill Carey, a good friend of mine, as it happens, and he took on that case. I had long since left the commission, and he wrote a long, learned, carefully thought out opinion on this whole field of insider trading. But after that, Phil Loomis took a very strident attitude about insider trading, and he gave this opinion to a bunch of lawyers. A fellow says, a man is riding along in an aeroplane, New York to Washington or something, and he looks out of the window and he sees a fire. He says, gee, I know that company. I know there's a fire going on in their plant. And he, as soon as he gets home, he calls his broker. He says, there's a fire in that company. Sell my stock. And Phil Loomis said, that's a violation. Now, that, I think, is about as far as you can. But that's Phil Loomis, a big change from his initial reaction. What's the matter with that, Paul?
Yeah. But that was the traditional point of view, I guess.
It was the traditional point of view, but that's the job of a broker to get inside information.
Now, did that occur to you when you're sending... I know this all happened pretty quickly, but you send people out on the street to put this case together.
I was watching this thing all the time, we in the New York office. Every time there was a news break, I would ask our fellas on the tape, was there one about what trading was there? There was something instinctive with me about, I would like to know if there's a news break. Is there trading? Mm-hmm. Is there trading? If so, where does the trading come from?
Did you consider that this might set some precedent, as the Katie Roberts decision did?
No, it struck me as being outrageous that this guy asked to go to the bathroom. I think the real truth is he left the meeting, asked to go to the bathroom. But even more than that, they caused the company to delay the announcement on the broad tape for a couple of hours to give him time to get rid of all his stock. So I called it, my approach to it was, they asked me what I thought. I said, it's a fraud on the marketplace. I don't know whether you're interested in whether or not the fraud of the marketplace has integrity, but this has a fraud on the marketplace. And then Bill William Orange has popped in, you know, 10b-5, 10b-5. Now, he was a real old-timer. And let me mop it up, everything, with my leaving, because I had in mind the Thomas E. Dewey advice. I had lunch with Governor Dewey in his office, and one thing he told me, he had quite a way of putting things. He said, you know, when you're in office, there are any number of people who come up to you and say, we can't wait to hire you as our lawyer as soon as you get out of office. He said, by that time, he was over at the old Root firm taking the job that was held by Root, Ballantyne, Harlan, Bushby, John Harlan. John Harlan was the senior man there. Secundus Root had left and gone with another law firm. Dewey took over the firm. And he was there, invited me to lunch in his office. Actually, he wanted to pick my brain on something or other, and I didn't give him any comfort. But then we start talking about being in office and people coming up to you, lawyers coming up to you, or clients, would-be clients, saying, we can hardly wait till you get out, and right. We want to... And he said, you know, some of them may seriously mean it, but he said, you know, any number of them have said that to me. He said, do you want to know something, Paul? He says, the telephone never rang. You know, he'd look at you like that. The telephone never rang. So that was a word of advice to me leaving the commission. I was used to talking to the chairman of the stock exchange, talking to the big investment bankers, and all the time, just easily. And I thought, here's a new circle of friends. But it was a form of education, sophistication, a form of sophistication.
So he's telling you it's not going to be as easy as you might think.
Well, that's right. He said, don't count on the fact that you're going to get a lot of clients who thought, you know, he said they may have been acting in good faith. They may have been impressed by you, glamorized by being where you are. That's good. That's going to be my lawyer. He says, the telephone never, many came up to me, the telephone never rang. If that happened to Tom Dewey, you know, and so, Dewey and I just talked around, but several of the big firms. Well, one thing that happened was Bobby Kennedy, and he offered me his first appointment to the Federal District Bench when he got in. And Leonard Moore told me no. He said, you're too young to be a judge. I still was something like 38 or 39, so we... Leonard Moore told me, no, don't do that. You've never practiced law, and you should. And then some of the big firms with banking connections, established firms, they invited me in to chit-chat, and some of them made what could be termed an offer and the rest of that. And Leonard Moore says, You won't be happy in any of those places. You just, it's not going to work for you. So then I went back to Johnny Burns' remnants of his old firm, and there were two lawyers left and three secretaries, so they had an office. So there I went, and here we are.
So this is that firm.
This is that firm, yes. This is where it all started, Johnny Burns.
How about that?
As I say, I gave this advice, you know, to Patricia's cousin, Dylan Ripley, who was the head of the Smithsonian. And I said to Dylan, you know, you're there in Washington, you've bought a big house right in the middle of it, and you're in the middle of Washington society. And I said, Dylan, you've got to realize something. As soon as you retire, you're a forgotten person. Washington, people get forgotten in Washington very fast and in government very fast. They're interested in people who can do something for them now. Mm-hmm. Of course, Dewey was bound to be a success because he was pragmatic and hard-hitting. He was the guy who got that nomination for Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would have gone either Taft or Douglas MacArthur or something like that. Eisenhower, you look on him as a big figure. He was just floating along. He was a name as far as Dewey was concerned.
Huh.
And Dewey did well. He's dead now, isn't he?
Yes.
So that was the end of that. But I was suspicious of that firm of his. He had several people who sort of had him almost as a prisoner. They wouldn't let him out of their sight and whatnot.
Well, something to wrap up with would be, what did your SEC experience teach you that you were able to bring into the rest of your career that changed the way you practiced law or did anything else?
Well, that's hard to say. You know, it taught me a lot about Washington and agencies, administrative agencies, and that it was easy to go back and look at things through the cynical eyes of Bill Douglas.
Tell me one more time what Bill Douglas said to you.
He said that every something like 20 or 30 years, the whole commission should be abolished. And they should start absolutely afresh with a completely new staff, new commissioners. He said because they live in a regulatory context with a wealthy, beguiling, very sophisticated, romantic kind of a world of international banking and securities and politics and society and all of that. And they get used to calling up people out on that world outside there, and the people are glad to talk to them, and then many of them do go and work for those people, and there's a steady flow, drifting of people coming out of the commission. All of that is true, but on the other hand, the commission basically is an admirable organization. It has an enormous amount of know-how. The world of enforcement is completely strange. It's almost inconsistent with the role they find that they're playing. And enforcement was something I had, in a sense, grew up with. I grew up with not the fancy J.P. Morgans, but the Firo of LaGuardia's, my father, Tammany Hall, all these corrupt cases, then getting into the Army and finding myself running a series in Germany, occupied territory in France, and then coming back here and going into the U.S. Attorney's Office and finding that I was taken to it very naturally. And so but it's a different world. Now, how does the SEC mate with that? How does it not, in a sense, get caught in a lapse over the enforcement aspects? How does a guy like Spritzer come along, go into Wall Street in no time at all, hit the headlines, and then the SEC... And everybody says, well, where is the SEC? The SEC says, well, we're short on personnel or something like that, that usual government answer. And Spritzer said, that's a lot of nonsense. I did all this with three lawyers.
Right.
SEC
says, we do it differently.
Well, their approach is, regulation is not a substitute for enforcement. Enforcement has to come in and give a bite to regulation. It has to give a bite to disclosure. It has to make these keep these people a bit on edge, and you can't be too cozy with them. Mm-hmm. And it's not hard for the SEC, when they're dealing with the top flight people in these big investment banking firms who talk in terms of huge amounts of money and easily at world, the top social world, the top political world, top international diplomatic world, that they're at ease there. And so SEC people start to feel like, geez, I call these people, they're glad to talk to me. I must be something. That's not true, you know.
Yeah, that's what Tom Dewey was telling you.
So what happened here, I give a lot of credit to Cinc Armstrong, because he woke up in the morning and here these cases, these Telia cases, were in the newspaper. And he was in New York. He came over to see me in my office, in the U.S. Attorney's office. And he walked into a world in which here were all sorts of people, FBI, Asian Secret Service people, and so forth. And here was the grand jury room down there. And people, indictments were being found, and reporters were running around, and people were being arrested left and right. And he walked into that, and he must have wondered, what the hell? But on the other hand, here are these things. I've got to ask Windels what these cases are about. And I told him, I said, you're dealing with people who have been dealt with very harshly as a result of these boiler room stuff. Right. They're savings. They're not big people. They're little people, right, who had money put in a milk bottle and things like that. Want to send my niece to college. Can you imagine working a foot press? She couldn't walk without a cane. And that was with Will, because Tim Callahan, he was big and huge, and he was right in the middle of that Yale football team. 60 minutes of every game. They didn't have this business of platoons then.
Yeah.
Yale was there, Tim was there 60 minutes of every game. And the Yale Bowl, that was his territory. And there he was. And put on Walter Camps all time, this, that, and the other thing. And yet he was so quiet and sensitive and just the sort of a person Rose Kennedy would feel comfortable with, because he was the top social people over there in Boston tended to be WASPs and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so the Fitzgeralds would be a little bit on thing, but Timmy had gone to Andover, he'd gone to Yale, or Yale Law School, and on top of all of that, he was a completely cultivated man. I'll tell you one story. Rose Kennedy was in the hospital in Washington giving birth to Teddy. And Joe was off in Hollywood. You see, he had this Kennedy thing of movie actresses. I forget the name of this particular actress, but it was big time, very big time. And here was Joe Kennedy there. Rose was in the hospital, and here she was in bed with little baby Teddy. And here was Timmy Callahan, her old girlhood buddy. And you can imagine these two old Boston Irish people just chitting, chatting together so nicely and feeling comfortable with each other. And they were going on like that. And then the doorbell rang, and then came this great big floral display thing with a card. So they gave Rose the card. She read it. She looked at Tim. She pointed to the window. Went like that. She pointed to the flowers. Went like that. And Timmy put the flowers right out the window. And then she showed him the card. It was very best wishes signed, this actress out there, whoever the hell she was. Imagine the gall of those people. And this Rose Kennedy was on a higher level in a sense than these cheap people.
Yeah.
But Joe Kennedy had this thing for Hollywood and for showgirls.
Yeah.
And the underworld.
Right.
The liquor business.
Right.
Big in the liquor business.
Very, very surprising for the first chairman of the SEC.
Well, I had clients when I got out. For me, the practice of law was fascinating. And a big part of my clientele got to be in the liquor business. And the people in the liquor business, the big shots, were mostly former bootleggers. So I had this group of people, the Reinfeld family. They changed their name to Renfield. And they bought out the Kennedy interests in liquor importing business, the Kennedy exclusives, all of their things that they had. And the reason was that the Kennedys needed the money. They were buying merchandise in Chicago. So they wanted to dump, and also they were getting further and further into higher and higher politics. So this was a good way for them to be nudging away. So I went over to London with my clients because I wanted to make sure that they got everything that they were buying, that they were going to be the exclusive agents for these, particularly these big Scotch brands. Who was that Scotch? The guy who was a field marshal in the British Army? The Queen of England. The Haig family.
Oh, yes.
Haig family. The Haigs had a house on 10, and right in the middle of London. That's where we were meeting. St. Paul's, number 10, whatever square. So I'm there with all these Reinfelds, Renfields, now funny people. I had more fun with them. And so we went in and we were there, 10 St. James Square. And we were having lunch with the chairman. And the chairman had originally, before he became chairman, had been the aide-de-camp of Marshall Haig, who was the head of the whole Haig apparatus. And we were having lunch and talking casually. And so he said, you may be interested in this thick old Scotch accent as to how we got in, how we got into this thing with the Kennedys. He said the day Prohibition was repealed, it was effectively signed by FDR. The very day he was to sign it, into our office downstairs came Mr. Elliot Roosevelt and Mr. Joseph Kennedy. And so we knew Mr. Joseph Kennedy very well because we had been doing business with him over the years, all during Prohibition. But we never had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Roosevelt. So I went up to Earl Haig and I said, well, what should we do? They're downstairs. And he said, invite them for tea. Typical British. And then so that gave them time. They called the Foreign Office and they said, give them anything they want. So they came in, and what do you want? We want an exclusive on the Haigs, Gordon Gin, etc., etc., etc. So they got it all signed, sealed, and delivered. This was the day Prohibition was declared ended. And then Jimmy Roosevelt and Joe Kennedy then left for Southampton, got on a boat for the U.S. They didn't stay around another second. They got what they wanted. They got on the boat. On the boat going home, Joe Kennedy says, it's not going to look right for you to be a partner in this liquor business with me. And so he bought him out for $25,000 cash on a boat going home. And our Rheinfels paid, it must have been $25 million by the time we were through. Wow. They bought the Kennedys out. I don't think it was $25 million, but I think it was maybe $5 million or some more than that, a lot.
Can't argue with his business instincts. That's
no.
Sure.
I made two recommendations as I left. Anybody who had a position on the staff of the commission or had a position with the commission and retired, left the commission, should not appear before the commission for 2 years. Now, that was one thing. Mm-hmm. That was one. And some of the nice fellows on the commission, the commissioners, they were common sense, and I admired them all and respected them all. And they said, Paul, you've got to be reasonable about this. There are fellows here who's spent a lot of life working very hard in the commission. They're basically their technicians. And to rob them of the ability to go out is pretty tough. You can say that you're not going to come back, and indeed I didn't. I couldn't face going back to these guys who were my, you know, easygoing companions. But that's one thing for you. Another thing I said, and this, I suggested that there be an exchange, that personnel going, careerists going on the staff of the commission, lawyers particularly, be placed in the two big divisions with Corp Fin and Trading and Exchange, or Corp Fin and Enforcement, and that everybody sort of going in enforcement should have a tour of duty in Corp Fin, a good tour of duty in Corp Fin, and anybody going in Corp Fin should have a tour of duty in enforcement. Bonnie Woodside shot that down. He said, no, he says, I worked very hard to keep everything. We're very particular about our training and this and that, and we don't want people drifting in and out from one division to another. But it was shot down by Bonnie Woodside.
Everybody's got to specialize, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, no. Look, I'd like to thank you very much for talking to me today about
it. Okay, well, it's good talking to you.